This is the Wheeler Center podcast. In this episode of the Wheeler Center podcast, we'll hear from American literary power couple Michael Chabon and Eilet Waldman. They joined us in Melbourne for an intimate and illuminating conversation about love, collaboration, work, and family on the 4th of November 2015. But that recording didn't quite work out. So instead, we're bringing you a recording of their conversation one night earlier at Sydney Opera House.
So when Sophie was born, I was raised by a very feminist mother, 1970s classic feminist mother, you know, the group of ladies in the living room with speculum and the whole kit and caboodle. Was my third grade teacher, which nobody should ever have to see, but I did. But my mother's big message to me was, you find a man who, unlike your father, you find a man who will cook and who will clean and who will raise the children so that you can go out and have a job. And so when I met Michael, it was ideal. He was this man who was, first of all, great cook, second of all, much cleaner than I am, third of all, fully prepared. He works at night. He starts work at 10 o'clock at night. He wakes up at 10 o'clock, 10, 11 in the morning. He's there to take care of the kids all day. It was this beautiful, ideal system.
I mean, and I came of age at the same moment, but for a boy, we had this program called Free to Be You and Me.
Did you ever hear that?
Did that make it over here ever? It was this sort of like very 1973
Marlo Thomas
feminist TV program for kids, like a special with a record that was
right,
and it had all these things about women being able to do whatever they wanted in life. Girls could grow up to be engineers and boys could grow up to be ballet dancers, whatever. And one of the pieces in this was a song based on a book called William's Doll about a boy who wanted a doll and his parents freaking out about giving him a doll, but he wanted to learn how to take care of a baby and be a good father, and that made a big impression on me at the time, so I kind of always grew up with this ambition to be really involved as a father with a baby.
So we had this baby, and I did exactly what I expected to do and what my mother told me to do, which is I went right back to work. And I gave Sophie to Michael, and I went back to the office, and at the time I was a public defender working in Los Angeles doing large-scale drug conspiracies and bank robberies and all sorts of wonderful things.
You weren't doing them.
No, I was representing
them. That came later.
They were fun days. I had an order of protection from the 137th Avenue Crips, I believe it was, so that as long as the people who jacked my car were wearing blue, not red, I was protected and safe.
Mm-hmm. But if you were in Crenshaw.
Yes, exactly. If I was in the other side of town, things were a little more dicey. Mm-hmm. But then I went back to work, and I still loved my job. I still loved what I was doing every day, but I would get like...
I don't think you loved it as much as you had before.
No, I really didn't, because you were spending all day. I had this image. You were spending all day, and what he would do is, we had someone come in the early morning when I went off to work, but then as soon as Michael woke up, the nanny would go away, and he would spend the day dressing up the baby in little outfits and taking her picture and then changing her clothes.
That's what you do with a baby.
And taking her picture.
William's doll. What did I say? I wanted a doll.
And they would they had a little baby pool in the backyard, and they would be, and all, you know, there were always these photographs being sent around, these like little baby pool. And then he would go to story time at the library, and he had this whole group of mommy friends, and they were like meeting up for coffee, it seemed, and going to story time together. And there's nothing more charming in the world than a man taking care of a newborn baby. I mean, can you imagine what everybody did for him and the way they treated him out and about in the world? Like he was basically Jesus. I remember that time there was a woman, he was standing in a cafe.
That was much later. I was at a much more lax point in my fatherhood. That makes this story even
more poignant.
Well, tell
them what you were doing.
This was with our last kid, our fourth, Abe, when he was about a year and a half old. I was at the local corner grocery store, and I was like holding him like this. He was wearing only little pants, no shirt. His face was filthy, you know, with that crust they get with like the snot and dirt all just like, and his hair was terribly messy, and you know those wire paper and wire twist tie things they have at the grocery store for tying up your bags of produce? He had one of those, and he was chewing on it with wire. a piece of wire. He was like chewing on it, and I'm just holding him, and I'm not looking at him or talking to him or anything. And this woman's like, I look over and she's like just like beaming at me. And finally, I'm like, you know, can I help you? And she's like, I can tell you, you're a really great dad.
Can you imagine what a mother would have to do to get that comment from a stranger? Can you imagine?
Well, like I said in that piece, like, right. You know, like you'd have to be doing an emergency tracheotomy on one child while
breastfeeding the other.
Choosing nutritious snacks. And,
right, exactly.
Yeah, and then even so, they'd still be like, that's what a mom does.
Anyway, but it seemed so delightful what they were doing, the two of them, and they seemed to be having so much fun, and I was so jealous, not just of him that he was spending all this time with her, or maybe not even mostly of him, but of her that she was spending all this time with him. Mm-hmm. And it suddenly seemed like there was this whole life that I was missing out on. And it was particularly true because when you do this kind of public interest law, you know, in the United States, we have these catastrophic sentences for drug offenses, 10-year mandatory minimums, 20-year mandatory minimums.
For tiny offenses.
For tiny offenses, for just being, you know, the guy who carries a box in a drug deal
or
gets
like
20
if
years.
If you take a phone message.
Yeah, or take a phone message, and that's enough for you to go to jail for a decade. And so if you represent those people, you are their only voice, and the whole government is arrayed against them. And so I had to give everything all day long at work.
A lot of them are young too.
And yeah, many of them were young. And I just was, you know, I gave any emotional and intellectual energy I had all day at work. And then I would come home at the end of the day and Michael would kind of pitch the baby at my head and rush off to his office to do I don't even know what on his computer, but not that what you're thinking, but and then I was so tired and so drained that Sophie would she would look at the television and she would point her finger at it and she would go, "Rawr," which meant, "Can we watch The Lion King?" And I would say, "Of course, yes, exactly." And I would turn on The Lion King every single day after work. And at some point, one day I did that, and Sophie and I sang from the very first lyric, which is I don't know, maybe Swahili or maybe just what Disney thinks Swahili is. Mm-hmm. Through every song, every line of dialogue, every sound effect to the end, 88 minutes to the end of the movie. And I thought, the American Academy of Pediatrics does not call this parenting. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment that I decided that I was going to come home and be a stay-at-home mother. And I think that was when I gave you my Vera Nabokov speech.
Was it that day?
Yeah, do you remember that?
That was the most beautiful day of my life.
Yeah, so what did I tell you?
You just said, you know what, I'm just going to be like Vera Nabokov and just devote myself to your genius.
So do you know, like Vera Nabokov, when Nabokov would give speeches, she would sit in the front row, and if he accidentally dropped his papers to the ground, she would rush up and pick them up and hand them to him and then stand back. In addition to opening his mail and licking his envelopes and carrying the umbrella and opening it over his head. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I could do that. I could do that. For about a day, I thought that.
I don't even know if it was quite 24 hours before you abandoned that career in disgust. You know, and this was That was the turning point for you was Sophie, but right around that same time was when Wonder Boys was published, and it turned out to be a big turning point for me, which I didn't really anticipate, or in a way that I didn't anticipate, which is that the book did well and it got good reviews, and one of the really favorable, great reviews that it got was from the Washington Post, and the book critic, the senior book critic there at the time, was a man named Jonathan Yardley, and he wrote this very positive review, very strong review, and then he ended it with this paragraph that essentially said something like, you know, there's one caution in order here. This is Chabon's second novel, and like his first novel, it's rather limited in scope, it's kind of a small scale novel, and you know, one wishes that he might apply his voice and style to some bigger subject matter, some, you know, some
wider canvas.
Wider canvas, exactly. And, you know, that was exactly what I had tried to do in Fountain City. That's what I thought I was going to do next for my second book. And indeed, I had just retreated with the second book with Wonder Boys in that it was set in the same place in Pittsburgh as my first book. It had a small cast of characters. It took place over an even briefer period of time, a weekend instead of a whole summer, as in the first book. And when I read that review, just Yardley's words really resonated with me. And I thought, you know, I tried. And I thought, you know, I still... Maybe, you know, I'll try again. I wonder what I ought to write about. And it was right around that time two things happened. One is I had been carrying this box of the last surviving box from my childhood comic book collection. You know, and I'd probably had, I don't know, I had a lot of comic books as a kid. My dad would buy them for me and read them and then give them to me. He has obsessive compulsive disorder, so he would read them very carefully and keep them all like they looked newer than they did when he bought them. And I had sold them all to a 14-year-old I knew who, you know, later went on to become, you know, a Wall Street mogul or something. I don't know, but he took me for about, I think I sold him for $1,000. And I don't even like to think about what they would be worth today if I still had them. But I had this one box left, and I had taped it up. It was all the comic books drawn by this one artist, Jack Kirby, who was always my favorite. And I kept it, and I never... Thank you. And it just stayed like that for years. And then one day, right around this time, right around the time of the Yardley review, I cut the box open. I was trying to procrastinating. I was supposed to be working, I think. And you know, this just smell of old comic books... not all of them in their plastic bags the way they're supposed to be, came just pouring out, and it was such a powerful sense memory for me, the smell of the comics and just the time in which I had read them and the strong connection to my father, who had grown up reading comic books in Brooklyn in the 40s and 50s, and it felt like there's a book in this box somewhere. Then I read the article about Simon and Schuster, the two kids from Cleveland, Ohio, who created Superman in 19...
Simon and...
Siegel and Schuster.
Siegel and Schuster.
Yeah. Do I say Simon and Schuster? Did I?
How about me noticing?
Nice. Simon and Schuster, publisher. Siegel and Schuster, Superman. Simon and Kirby, comic books. And I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. These two guys, and they create a character, and... it seemed fun. It sounded really fun to me, but it also sounded sort of unlikely. And in fact, I had the experience many times in the course of the long haul of writing that book, where I would tell people, what's your book about? I would try
tell them
to
about that
it.
Dinner at the McDowell Colony.
One night at there's an artist colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire, called the McDowell Colony, and people. From every discipline of art, go there to do work.
Any of you who are writers, artists, you should apply to the McDowell Colony mm-hmm. because it's a wonderful...
I was there with two Australians last time I was there.
And it's great. We love to get international writers and artists.
Anyway, the people I was with at dinner were all writers, happened to be at this one table, and somebody said, well, what's your book about? And they kind of went around the table, and like one person was writing a novel. She's like, I'm writing a novel about a fugitive slave in the South who like gets caught up in some kind of an expedition. And everyone's like, whoa, that sounds really good. And the next person's like, I'm writing about this family that was in a terrible fire, and their lives are ruined, whatever. And you know, everybody's like, oh my God, that sounds so amazing. And then I'm like, I'm writing a novel about two guys who create a comic book superhero in the 1940s in New York, and there was just silence. Like nobody, no one said anything. It was so awkward and so painful, and then they're like, cool. And, you know, it didn't seem obvious at all, except the one person that just right away, and it's kind of surprising because she was not a comic book reader or lover or anything. You had no real... relationship to comic books. I don't think that's what you focused in on. I
focused on your sparkle. It was Wonder Boys. I could see it effervescing. I could see how excited it was. Mm-hmm. I could see that it was, you know, it was going to be the same kind of experience. So I said, just go.
So that was a Yardley review really turned me to.
And then you had to go to New York. And that was another turning point for me, because he had to go do this research in New York City.
The book
we were living
was set
in California.
In New York.
And I was a federal employee with a federal employee's vacation days, which in the United States is about 3 weeks in the whole year. So I quit my job. And I just thought, all right, I'm going to go and I'm going to be a law professor. I'm going to quit this job that I used to love but don't anymore, and we're going to go to New York, and Michael's going to research Cavalier and Clay, and I'm going to go be a law professor, which means I have to write a law review article, which is a footnote-heavy tome on a tiny, esoteric legal issue that nobody has ever written about before, that will be published or cared about in a journal that no one will ever read, but that's what you have to do if you want to be an academic. Any academics in this audience? Have I summed it up accurately?
I mean, with law notes, it's even more
tiresome and dull.
Picayune and, yeah.
So we went to New York, and Michael started doing research on his book.
I had the 1939 WPA, the Works Progress Administration, guide to New York City as a way to sort of make work for writers during the Depression. One of the things the government did was have these guides prepared to major regions and cities in the U.S., and there's this beautiful book about New York City that was published in 39. John Cheever was one of the writers, and Richard Wright was one of the writers, and it's beautifully written, and I took that book and used that as my guidebook, so I didn't look at anything that wasn't there in 1939 when my book was starting out. And
I went to New York.
We traded the baby.
Right, we traded the baby, and I went off to write this law review article, and I would go to the New York University Law Library, and the first thing I would do is fall asleep. Every day. Because I had a baby, and also it was so boring. It was just, there's never been anything as boring. And then one day, I just started writing.
Why? Do you remember, like, what the initial impulse was?
At that day? It was like you said, I just had this idea of this character in my head, and I just thought, wouldn't it be funny if I just wrote that for us? And I thought I was doing it for like an afternoon. I just thought, I'm just going to spend this afternoon writing this murder mystery. And I had read so many murder mysteries, and I thought, I could maybe. So I just started doing it as a joke, as a lark, as a way to do anything other than write this tiresome law review article. But of course, I couldn't say anything, right? Because the member of the toast at the wedding. Mm-hmm. So I would go to the law library.
And the toast police are very, in the U.S. anyway, they're, yeah.
So I'd go to the law library, and I would slave away in the law library, and
You kept it a secret.
And I kept it a complete secret. And it was fun. And I don't know why you didn't notice that I was suddenly having fun the way I noticed that you were suddenly having fun. But we had a baby by then, so I don't think either of us were noticing much at all.
You're a better actress than I am, too. You're better at hiding
things. That's
true.
I have a better poker face.
Yeah.
So at the end of this month in New York City, I said to Michael...
It was like 45 or 50 pages.
Yeah, much as he said to me, I said, all right, I have a confession to make. I have written the beginning of a book. It's not a literary novel. It's just a lighthearted, silly murder mystery. But I need you to tell me if this is any good, because I am not going to waste my time doing something bad. I was a very competitive academic student. I was a competitive lawyer. You don't go to Harvard Law School unless you have, like, you know, blood in your teeth. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to do anything half-assed. Mm-hmm. So I said to him, just look at this and tell me, and I can stop at any minute. And what did you think?
Well, I was terrified. I mean, I just... completely absent the fact of I yell at being my wife and all that stuff, just like anybody asking you to read 45 pages of their manuscript who's not already Michael Ondaatje or something like that is terrifying. Because that question of, like, how honest can I be? What if this is awful? What am I going to say? And then that it was my wife and I was going to have to possibly, like, I didn't think it was going to be good or bad. I just worried in the case that it wasn't good, how was I going to handle that situation? But just almost immediately, I relaxed as I was reading. Now, even this was not her first, this did not become her first novel. She put it aside. But And it had all kinds of problems that it just, it didn't really kind of get going, and she hadn't quite figured out what her plot was going to be, or she knew the crime, but she, you know, it was, it had a lot of flaws, just like you would imagine from somebody's first attempt ever to write a novel. But what it had just from the very first sentence, it was a strong voice. It was a narrated in the first person, and it just crackled with vitality from the very first sentence and from the first paragraph. And you could just tell, I think partly what I could hear in that, which is what you can almost always hear in a piece of writing with a strong voice, whether it's a first person or third person, is someone who's read a lot of books and has paid attention to how writers handle language and knows how things are supposed to sound, like how a first sentence ought to sound. It was like nobody had ever told her a first sentence should, you know, lay out a strong voice or get a sort of a little, already a little bit of mystery bubbling in the reader's mind about who's telling the story and what their deal is. But she just did it. And the first paragraph kind of started just the way a first paragraph of a murder mystery ought to start. And she just had that, you know, you might call it an intuitive sense, but I think it's also very important. It's so important to read a lot as a writer. That's how you actually learn how to write, is by reading. And she is such a passionate reader. You'd read so many murder mysteries. You'd read like thousands and thousands
of them.
Of course, as soon as she began to write them, she stopped reading them.
I know, that's the terrible thing about writing a murder mystery. You can never write them again because you recognize that the very first time you see the murderer, you know who it is.
I mean, she's still...
I can't read them at all anymore.
What's the Danish...
Was the Dennis Lehane...
What's the Danish TV show, too?
Like, oh, the Borgen.
The other one.
The Killing.
I won't give anything away, but like the moment the actual killer appeared on screen, before he'd almost said a word or done anything, she was like, that's the guy.
And I ruined that. And it's like
and it
20
was.
It's
And that was like
episodes.
20 episodes later. And there were like 15 red herrings between the beginning and the end.
But he loyally hung in there for all
I was like,
them.
nah. Couldn't have been him.
So we're going to skip.
Okay.
Because of time. We're going to skip to 10. So we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about the turning point, yeah.
Okay.
Because of the sort of the book thing, we're going to try to elevate the discourse a little bit.
Okay,
so that
because we've been really rolling in the mud here for long enough. Oh, yeah, okay. So, well, this was a big one for both. We when we started just talking about this, we both realized we hadn't quite put it this way to ourselves. We both had... Or to each other, we had these important moments for us of liberation from self-imposed limitations, where things that we just would have either automatically assumed or had been told or sort of knew vaguely we couldn't do, it turned out that we could. And for me, it came while I was writing this book, a short novel of mine called *The Final Solution*, which is a story about a very elderly man who was once a great detective in London in the 1880s and 1890s, who has retired to keep bees in Sussex, but is never identified by name as Sherlock Holmes. People always like, is that copyright reasons? Were you trying to avoid, copyright infringement? And I think actually, I should have been trying to avoid copyright infringement. Well, it seems like, at least in Britain, I think it would have been an issue. But the answer is no. It was such a well-trafficked character. So many people, not only Arthur Conan Doyle, but dozens, hundreds of writers since then have written their own Sherlock Holmes things. I wanted to try to do something. I wanted to come at the character in a totally different way, and I just found that the name Sherlock Holmes prevented me from doing that, so I just started calling him the old man. And that allowed me to the kind of freedom to write about him in the way I wanted to. Nevertheless, I had this structure which I borrowed not from Arthur Conan Doyle, but from Robert Louis Stevenson in his novellas. This is a novella where typically he, in many cases, at least in the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the novellas have chapters, and each chapter is from a different point of view, or there's a few points of view in the course of the novella. And I wrote along, and it's a mystery. There's a crime. There are red herrings. There's a solution. There's the actual person who committed the crime, which is murder and parrot theft. And I realized, oh my God, I got to the end, toward the end, and the only entity who actually saw the murder committed and knows who did it is the parrot. And even though this parrot can talk and is a very learned parrot in many respects, he's not capable of that kind of, he can't say, you know, he was the one in the races, he done it. I didn't know what to do. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me like the only solution to this is to go into the parrot's point of view. And I felt like, I don't think you can do that. I mean, I read Black Beauty a long time ago, and that's from the horse's point of view. I loved it, but, you know, that was kind of sui generis in many ways, and there haven't been a whole lot of novels since then written by horses. I didn't have the nerve, I thought it was people would just think it was wacky, and it just so happened, right at that moment, as I got to that chapter, I was corresponding by email with Salman Rushdie, and who's not not my best friend or anything like that, but I was trying to get him to participate in this anthology I was editing for McSweeney's, and I had been corresponding, and this was the day, and I just thought, you know who's going to know the answer to this question? Salman Rushdie. So I said, and I kind of laid it out, and here's what I'm doing, and I really feel like I kind of need to write a chapter from the point of view of a very intelligent parrot. Can I do that? And he wrote back a two-word reply, you must. And that was, how am I going to argue with Salman Rushdie? So, and not only did it work and solve my narrative problem and lets the reader know who done it, but I loved it. It's hard to try to write from the point of view of a parrot. I really had to think, what would a parrot be thinking? What would a parrot's sense of being a parrot and being owned by people and being kept in cages and parrot, these parrots, African greys, live a long time. He's probably had many owners. You know, it was such a beautiful experience for me to get out of a human mind entirely. And I'm not claiming I know what a parrot thinks like, but my version was very pleasurable. And that was a real turning point for me. It just made me feel like you could write from anyone's point of view that you want to, even a parrot's point of view. And so then when it came time for me to write my most recent novel, Telegraph Avenue, I felt that, you know, even though I knew it was a fraught thing to be trying to do, part of what I do in that book is write from the point of view of African-American characters and get way down deep into their points of view just as much as I do into, and have always done, into the points of view of white characters. And at one point, even trying to take it so far as to be in the point of view of a black woman while she's giving birth. So double the experiences I've never and never will have. I didn't hesitate because I knew that it was okay to try to expand your powers of point of view, thanks to Sir Salman.
And I had a similar experience when I was writing Love and Treasure, my most recent novel, which is a novel that takes place against the backdrop of the Holocaust, though never during, it's before and after the war. And I had felt this terrible sense of lack of authority, lack of authenticity. You know, I did not lose any family members during the Holocaust, any close family, of course, all of my extended family. And I just felt so presumptuous. How dare I, you know, try to do that thing that they say you're not allowed to do, which is make art about the Holocaust. And I was so nervous and so afraid of engaging in Hebrew, the word for Holocaust is Shoah, and they have a phrase in Israel, they call it the Shoah show. You know, the kind of the market of Holocaust art. And I was so nervous and anxious about that. And I was sort of going back and forth about whether I was going to do this and if I could do this. And I was in Budapest interviewing an expert in the art of the Jugendstil, the Art Nouveau, in jewelry of that period. Because I have a piece of jewelry in the novel. And I sat down with this this very tiny little man. And and we sat down, we ate, we were in a cafe, to all of you writers out there, I highly recommend you set all of your books in Budapest because all research must be done at cafes with pastry. And we were eating our pastries and drinking our coffee, and he was telling me, and we were all about the history of the movement, and we were looking at different photographs of jewelry, and it was very fascinating. And I was telling him,
a Hungarian man.
A Hungarian, yes. Yeah. And at some point, I was telling him a little bit about the story of the book, and he very quietly sort of looked around and he asked me in a very soft voice, he said, "Are you a Jew?" And in all my American self-confidence, I said, "Yes, yes, I am a Jew." You know, daring the anti-Semites of Hungary at large to take away my cake. And and he looked around again and he said, "I am also a Jew." And I asked him, you know, he was an older man, he was in his 80s, and I said, "Well, 70s, I think, what happened to you during the war?" And he told me that during the war, he was a small child, and he and his mother had actually been in Paris during the war, and he had gotten whooping cough. They'd been living in a boarding house with lots and lots of refugees from Poland, Jewish refugees from Poland, from Hungary, from all sorts of places. And after the Nazis invaded, he became sick with whooping cough, and his mother took him out to the countryside to recover. And when they came back, their boarding house had been emptied, and everyone in the boarding house had been deported to the Velodrome and ultimately to the concentration camps in Poland. All of them were dead. And his mother managed somehow to get papers saying that they were Hungarian, as they were, but that they were Catholic Hungarians. And she took him back to Budapest, and they went to a part of the city where the Jews didn't live, in Buda rather than in Pest. And she took an apartment, and she presented herself to her new neighbors as a Catholic Hungarian. But the problem was she had a son, and he bore on his body the evidence of their religion. So she put him to bed. And this was in the beginning of the war, right after after the invasion of Paris. And he stayed in bed for the entire length of the war until the siege of Budapest and the liberation of Budapest by the Russians, in bed his entire childhood. And he told me that that's why he was so small, that he didn't grow when he was in bed. And he told me the story, and I said to him, you have to write this story, you have to tell this story. You have to go to schools and you have to talk about this story. And he said to me, "In Hungary, we always say that the war was difficult. It was difficult for everyone." And I said, "Well, yes, it was difficult for everyone, but it was a little more difficult for some than it was for others." And he said, "No, in Hungary, if you are a Jew, you keep yourself quiet and you don't tell your stories. You don't make yourself known. You just say only that the war was difficult for everyone. I can't tell my story." And I sat there, and we were quiet for a moment. And then he said to me, "But you can tell my story." And at that moment, all of the doubts I had and about my right to address this massive topic just faded away. Because I could tell a story, and I do tell that story, and I felt suddenly that what Michael felt, that you have as a writer, any story that you can imagine, you have a right to at least try to tell.
Mm-hmm. And you celebrated by ordering another piece of Sacher torte, or
many more. So I think we are, in fact, almost out of time. I think we can say one little turning point. Close on one tiny turning point before we turn to questions. I think we should talk about...
Notice who's deciding these things.
I think we should talk about how payback is a bitch.
Oh, okay. Yes, let's. So, I mean, I think one of the questions we get asked most frequently is, you both have written personal essays, nonfiction essays, and you've written about your children. How do they feel about that? And sometimes another sort of related question we get is, are your children writers? Do they like to write? What's their relationship to writing? And that's what Ayel is talking about when she says payback is a bitch.
Our eldest daughter is in university and has decided to not only be a writing major, but to write a narrative nonfiction memoir. And I imagine this is going to be quite a turning point in
my life. Well, we will just have to find out, won't we?
So shall we take questions now? Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks. Oh, great. Wow, look at all that.
All right, you do these.
I'll sort
with these.
Through.
No, you start.
I'll sort.
You sort.
I'll sort.
You sort.
I'll
so So okay. I think
Some people submitted questions via the internet, so we have some of these, and then here are ones that were put into a fishbowl.
And then there's also microphones right here. So while you're lining up, we'll start with some of the ones that were submitted. Let's start with this one.
What's that?
And we'll go back and forth while we wait for questions. Is there a book or author that you vehemently disagree on? If I say that immediately comes to mind, I'm going to sound like such an idiot, but I'll just say it anyway. Michael's favorite writer is Proust. He reads Proust.
He's not my favorite.
He reads Proust. He loves him some Proust.
And it's pretty Proust is good.
I just can't get past the curtains. If those of you, there's like one 37,000 word section on a pair of curtains.
No.
And no matter how many times
there's candlelight too.
I wonder how many times I just can't get past the curtains. I've tried so many times. Anybody I love that you hate?
There is, but I feel like I don't want to say because it would embarrass. I don't vehemently dislike them, but I just don't get it.
You don't get it.
Yeah, but I don't want to.
It would just mean.
Yeah.
Is there one you want to go
there?
We have
this one. Here's one by a Zen Buddhist. here's one you're going to enjoy.
Yeah, okay.
Do you believe monogamy is a condition for a good marriage?
Ooh. Well, so...
Also, I have to say, look at this beautiful handwriting. It's beautiful.
Look, do you want to take this?
No, I want to hear what you say first.
Well, I'm a big fan of... Do you guys know who Dan Savage is, the sex columnist? I'm a big fan of Dan Savage, and I listen to him all the time. And in fact, I have kind of seeded sex education in our household to Dan Savage. When our children are old enough, I just let them listen to his podcast, and they can find out all sorts of things that they'd be too embarrassed to hear from mom and dad. But he has this whole thing about monogamish, that if you are, if you're monogamish, you have one central relationship, and then you can have your
others.
And that
person knows they're the most important person.
Yes, and then your others can be sort of sexual dalliances. I think that's fine, and I'm, fully in support of everyone who could do that, but that would never work for us.
No.
Because I am violently jealous.
That's part of the reason it would never work for us, is that you're violently jealous. I think the other part of the reason is I just don't have the energy. It's just too hard. It's too hard. I'm lazy and I like to stay home.
So, all right, here's another sex one. Do you read each other's sex scenes? Do you enjoy each other's sex scenes?
Well, yeah, by definition, we read each other.
Yeah, we read
everything. That we write. We don't have a lot of sex scenes.
I have totally gotten hot from reading some of your sex scenes.
I mean, so have I from my own, but... No, I'm trying to think. Do you have...
So desperately to ask you something I've never asked you about what happens when you write a sex scene, but I can't ask you that. Do you...
enjoy it?
Physically?
No.
Don't answer
No. No, I don't. That's a good question, though. That's a good question. No, again,
I never
too
thought
hard.
I could blush in front of a room full of people.
This is a rare occurrence. Let's put it this way. I don't really do them that often because I really don't enjoy reading them because I don't think they're usually that well done. So if I find I guess I could go that way. And I'll ask myself, is this going to help me in some way? Is it going to help my story? Is it going to persuade the reader of something I really need to persuade the reader about? If it's only going to be there to say, and then they had sex and here's what it was like, I won't do it. But so then when I do decide to do it, if it's not making my heart race a little bit, I'll cut it. It does have to sort of make me feel like
Yeah.
I would enjoy reading it if someone else had written it.
Right. And there's so much. Oh, my God. There's so, even the best writers can write so horribly about sex. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so hard to define what's good or bad, too. It can be kind of, or like, I'll read a book, I'll have read a book and think, oh, that had that really hot scene in it with that with great sex writing, and like, I need to read that for some inspiration of like how you do it well, and I'll go back and I'll find the passage, and it's like two sentences long, and there's nothing explicit, and I think, why did I think this was so intensely erotic? And then other things where the writer's working really hard to get you, well, just...
Yes,
you know,
that.
Excited. You know, it doesn't work at all, even though they're using every adjective in the book. And
this is sort of related, but there's a writer who I like very much, who's all of whose books I've read, but who has this persistent thing in his books where men are always finding themselves in states of
arousal
when they see friends.
I think the word is tumescent.
Yes, tumescent. They whenever they sort of see a friend they haven't seen in a long time, and it just sort of they get a boner. And I said to Michael, is this, and this is in more than one of this writer's novels, and I finally said to Michael, so is this like a thing? You like see a friend you haven't seen in a long time and you like get a boner? And Michael said, well, if you're gay, yes. So
yeah.
Anyway, next.
Let's see.
He is not, I should say.
Do you
this
have
writer.
A good one? Do you have a good one over there? Let's see. Oh, here's one. You met on a blind date and were engaged within 3 weeks.
Indeed.
How did you know this was it? I like how like these are good personal kind of. These are good questions. I like these.
Wait,
there's the second part. And how have you worked so it stayed that way?
That's the important part. Well, the first part was...
That's the easy part.
Michael was standing. I was living in this part, a really dodgy part of Manhattan, and so we had bulletproof glass in our lobby.
I had literally walked on crack vials to get to her.
That's true. And he was there standing between sort of two panes of bulletproof glass, and I looked through the first pane of glass, and I had this incredible thought, now I can finally stop dating. And I just knew from the first moment, and I don't believe in any of that, but I knew absolutely 100%.
Yeah, and I mean that in this, to begin to answer the second part of the question, I mean that was very important to us, and it remains very important to us, and knowing that we had started that way, we started with that intense certainty and that intense rush, got us through for a long time through hard places. Or we could, if something would just sort of remind us of that, if you can find ways to sort of remind you, or you stumble on ways that remind you of that moment, you know, that was very restorative, and it still is. And when we think about it, you know, it makes me smile, it makes me feel good. But we've been married for 22 years now, and you know, that it turns out that even as powerful as that experience was, it's not enough. Sometimes things get so hard that even that memory like isn't still quite enough. And what we've really had to try to do over the years is kind of establish something like right now that's happening. It's a source of strength to look back on your beginnings and your origins, but ultimately it's about like how are we talking to each other now? What tones of voice are we using when we speak to each other? How much time are we actually spending together? Are we looking each other in the eyes, or are we like on our screens? And and you know, sort of like really taking a hard look at our interactions and how we're dealing with each other. And that is hard, not only like hard to remember to do when you get so caught up in life, but it's also sometimes not very fun either. Like, it's hard work. You know, I think in a way the story of our meeting and our love at first sight and all that stuff was part of our youthfulness in a sense too. Like, it was kind of, we were young then, and we're more romantic in some ways. And now, having been through everything we've been through, and 4 children and all of these things that we've gone through, I think it's less about romance and more just about like really understanding that this is it. Like, we are where this is the rest of our lives, and this, and we have, and it's not like endlessly sort of deferring to when our kids are grown, we'll do this, or when,
right.
or when I'm done with this book, or when this, you get into this habit, especially when you have kids, of like thinking in terms of milestones, and they finished kindergarten, or they finished.
We'll prioritize our marriage after this happens, or after that,
mm-hmm.
and I think we've made a decision to prioritize it. Now and always,
mm-hmm.
I mean.
Or try to.
Try to.
Mm-hmm.
And try.
And that's not very romantic
to.
At all. It's like, it's
no.
about like put your phone away or whatever it is.
Right.
It's not, it's kind of pragmatic.
Look at me, pay attention to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to remember.
Mm-hmm. And it's also disconcerting to discover when you're, you know, as old as we are. Well, I'm 52 and Ayala is somewhat younger than that. And, you know, that you
50.
Still...
50. I'm 50.
You still...
I don't like saying it, but I'm just going to keep saying it until I have to stop.
Not only do we not always know each other still, but we really still don't know ourselves sometimes
mm-hmm.
very well for people who have been who we are for so long. And I think you have to stay open to the possibility that you don't know why you're not really looking at your motivations, or you don't really know why you do the things you do. And sometimes it's pure habit and nothing else. And some habits need to be broken. So,
good answer, baby.
Thank you. No one's lining up, so let's keep going.
No
huh?
line up.
No,
okay,
they asked all their questions.
Souls.
These are
okay,
great questions.
Keep going.
You have one you
no,
like
you
there?
Go.
Okay. Okay, you want to? How are you feeling about Oprah? We didn't do Oprah on the.
Oh yeah, you want to?
Should we skip Oprah?
No, no, we
you're
can do
good
Oprah.
For Oprah.
Yeah, I'm good for Oprah.
Okay, you gonna talk about how she smelled?
This is what he means. So I wrote that essay about how I love him
can
more.
Want to hear
I
the question?
Yeah. Okay.
How did Oprah smell? No. The first time I saw you was on Oprah 10 years ago. What you wrote about resonated with me. How did you deal with the vitriol and fallout from your article? That you loved your husband more than your kids. Do you still love him more than your kids?
Our kids are ranging in age from 12 to 20, so hell yeah, I love him more than love my kids. Right? very briefly, I wrote an essay in which I said that all of these women I knew were in these sexless marriages, and in thinking about why I wasn't in a sexless marriage, I had decided that the reason was because they were all very good mothers, and they had prioritized their children more than anything else and focused all of their emotional and sensual energy on their children, not in a creepy way, but in a maternal way, and that I had somehow failed to do that. I had failed to prioritize my children above my husband, and that while I loved my children dearly, I wasn't in love with them. I was still in love with my husband, and I wrote that if a good mother is a mother who loves her children more than anyone else in the world, well, then I'm a bad mother because I love my husband more than my children. So that little essay was supposed to be in a literary anthology that nobody in their right mind would ever read, let alone buy.
Or not that they wouldn't be in their right mind. But
no, but they just
they would never
don't,
see it.
But they would never see it. People
yeah.
don't buy those there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow it got picked up by the New York Times. I did not submit it. It just kind of happened. It was on the coffee table of the editor of the New York Times Modern Love column. And they called me and they said, hey, we saw your essay. Can we put it in the New York Times? And without contemplating the difference between your essay about your sex life being published in an anthology that nobody's going to read and it being in the New York Times that conservatively
on Sunday.
5 million
mm-hmm.
people read, I said, sure. And the outcry, I mean, it was, I had no
Can
joke.
I just say the first indication that maybe something was like going awry and sort of the dialogue, the national dialogue, was the email I got that afternoon that it was published in the Times from Grill Marcus, the rock critic, dean of rock critics, that said, hey, sex god. Remember that? I was like, oh, honey. Honey, actually, can I continue to
yeah,
tell
yeah.
story a little bit?
Yeah,
Are you
yeah.
ready for
yeah, yeah, go ahead.
So people start responding and you know, emails and calling and whatever they're writing about,
thousands
it, they're blogging
emails,
about it,
radio
and,
shows,
and it's like both
daytime
personally
television.
Embarrassing for me, and they're attacking. I yell it, and she's starting to think like, "What did I say that was so bad?" And it, you know, whatever. But mostly I was embarrassed. And I mean, from my point of view, that was my primary concern. And and then at some point, after kind of a longish day with various people responding in various ways, I remember just sort of like plummeting back on our bed, like lying across the bed, and going, "Oh well, okay. At least it's not like you went on Oprah."
Literally that day, the phone rang. And it was Oprah show. And they said, Oprah agrees with you, is what they said. Would you come on the show to talk about, because Oprah has diagnosed this general malaise in her audience, and she feels like this is part of it. And would you come and talk about it, you and Oprah, and you can bond over this experience. And I had one thought in my mind. When your book is on the Oprah show, and it's an Oprah book pick, you sell 800,000 copies. And all I thought about was money. I thought, these voracious children
Fails.
And their needs. And I could go and I have this book that happens to be nothing about that, but I had a book and I could plug my book and I'll sell 800,000 copies and
They'll
we'll be rich.
It.
We'll be rich. That's what I thought of. So that's not how it happened. In fact, nowhere on the show do they either mention my book. In fact, if you click on my name on the website, it links to someone else's book. But I get to the Oprah show, and I beg Michael, and he's like, fine, do what you have to do. He has, he doesn't want to have to pay for these children anymore than I do. And I get to the Oprah show, and they're like, putting on my makeup, and I'm mostly very concerned with the fact that on the plane to Chicago, I have developed this monstrous pimple on my chin, this like Mount Vesuvius of zits, and I'm desperately afraid that I will go on.
It's like a sundial.
Exactly, we cast the shadow is the light. Mm-hmm. So I'm very concerned with if they're going to be able to like spackle out the rest of my chin to reach the zit, so that everything is. And I'm not really paying attention to anything they're saying. And then at some point I hear like this kind of shrieking noise, this cawing sound, and it's coming through the heating vent. And I say, what is that? And they say, oh, well, as we've been trying to explain to you, we've decided to go with a kind of alternate format today. We are going to have a living room discussion. We've assembled a group of mothers. They hate you, but hey, you are a criminal defense attorney. You're used to hostile juries. You'll be fine.
And also, and a Christian evangelist minister who agrees with
you. Yes, exactly. That was the other part. So I walk out on, they mic me up like this, and I walk out onto the stage, and there are all these mothers in the audience, and one of them literally screams, "Let me at her!" and leaps over her chair. And I am terrified. And then I have this thought, I do not need this crap. And I reach for my mic to unhook myself. And on the opposite sides of the stage, these double doors burst open. And in this halo of golden light walks this unearthly being. I mean, Oprah is, she's not even shaped like a normal person. Her head is like the sun. It is 10 times the size of a human head. She like exudes light and glow. And she smells like a field of flowers.
Frangipani.
And frangipani. She's just delicious. And she sits down next to me. And she takes my hand, and she leans over, and she whispers, "The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay was one of the best books I've read in years." And I thought, Oprah Book Club, that's the book we're going to sell. So I sat there, but then this was, and they were, I mean, they laid into me. They were vicious. But the thing was, Oprah did agree with me, and
Oprah had your back.
She had my back, and we were whispering together during the commercials, and she was stroking my head.
When the show aired, like when you first see Ayala, and the first time the camera finds her in the first minute, like, her chin is actually trembling. Like, she's like, oh my God. Like, it's sort of, you're still in that dawning horror of the situation, and then within minutes, Oprah has made it clear that she thinks all these women
are wrong.
So
it was like they were turning one of those like massive cruise ships in. You know how they are, and they turn them around, however they. And that's what it was like. She like turned the. So by the end of the show, they were all saying, "We love Ayala. We totally agree with Ayala."
The one woman that was the one that hated you the most, and they had filmed these segments. They had gone into some of these women's homes and filmed segments
what kind
of them
lunatic that's
talking
Oprah
about
film your
their
children.
Sex lives with their husbands and everything. And the very woman that was like most savagely bloodthirsty for you, she's like on camera talking about it during the interview portion. She's like, you know, sometimes when you know, I just watch TV while I let him do his business.
Yeah, she actually said that. I watch TV while I let him do his business.
So their credibility was somewhat impeached.
But then it was, at the end of the show, I just felt like Oprah and I felt such an intense connection. I mean, we really had this very close personal bond. And I...
She called you
right from the set. Yeah. And I said, oh my God, Oprah and I, you know how you meet someone and you know you're going to be friends forever? And we just, we felt that way. It was so intense. And we're going to be spending so much time together, I know. And you're going to have to learn how to play golf because Stedman plays golf. And it's, we're just... So, and then I came
home. She actually did say that.
And I wrote her this note like, oh, Oprah, the you, the me, the bond, the intense, the connection. It's so close. We're such good friends.
You sent her Amanda's book?
I sent her one of my best friends had died in a plane crash, and I had a few copies of her first novel that were inscribed in Oprah Collects first editions, and I sent her one of my precious first editions of Amanda's book. And I got back, I kid you not. You know how sometimes when you like accidentally feed something into the photocopier, like it's like crooked, it comes up. So I got like this crooked thing fed into the photocopier, and it said, "Dear guest, thank you for sharing your story." I know. So then I called Isabel Allende, who was at the time the only person I knew who'd been on Oprah, and I said, "Isabel, Oprah Winfrey," and she said, "Your best friend." For 48 minutes. And it was true. And I don't think it was fake. I think we were best friends. But we were just best friends for sure.
Mm-hmm. Great. Do you have one more? One more question?
Oh, there's someone standing there patiently
Please
in the dark.
Approach.
Sorry, this is mainly a question for Ayelet.
Closer to the microphone.
Sorry. You mentioned that you first started writing in that library after you've had a career and you've had a child. And I was just wondering, is being a writer something you ever thought about or played with? Is it something that you ended up prioritizing law over and you kind of wish you'd started earlier? Or?
This is funny.
You know, I always said no. I always said that I never, ever, that the first fiction I wrote was, you know, this murder mystery.
Aside from legal briefs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I as a criminal defense attorney, and a lot of what you do is you write letters to the judge about why your client deserves an early release or a lighter sentence, so it is rather creative writing in its way. But then, you know, years when my mother was cleaning out
her
attic.
I mean, this was your
years
story.
Years and years.
Never wanted to be a writer. You made a toast.
Yeah, right? I said I never wanted to be a writer. It was totally out of the blue. I never took a single writing class. And then my mother was cleaning out her attic, and she sent me my journals from when I was a little girl, and I didn't keep that many, but I did keep a few, and in one of them I write all about how I want to be a writer, and I even have all this like truly dreadful poetry, and so I think it was there, you know, I think what I was, as Michael said, was I have always been a reader. I mean, I write because I love to read, because reading is, you know, when they ask you in job interviews what your hobbies are, I never, ever had anything to say, because if you just say, well, I just read all the time, I mean, they want you to, like, you know, mountain climb or something, but if all you ever, ever do when you have free time is read or go to the movies.
Ayala reads everything. She reads every significant piece of literary fiction.
Well, I only have one rule. I only read writers who write better than I do, which means I have tons to read. There's like plenty that I can read. So I think the love of the word, the love of books, the love of fiction was always there. But that I love writing took me by surprise. But it's kind of a great thing to do. I mean, I do think there's this way when you're a mother, especially when you're a young mother, that you kind of lose so much of what is yours, your proprietary self. I mean, you have to give everything to your baby. You give your body, you give your, you know, your and everything you have. And it is so gorgeous to have like some tiny space that's just your own. And I think that whatever that space is, what it's really important as a mother, as a woman, to have that little space of creativity. I mean, whether you end up, you know, publishing or not, or, you know, just whatever it is, blogging, tweeting, knitting, it doesn't matter. I think it's really critical to have that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I got one here.
One more.
One more?
Yeah.
Okay. This is for me.
Okay, you can have it.
Thank you. You're going to enjoy this. Do you see any resemblance in your work to Jonathan Lethem's?
Wait, I have to first tell them this thing.
No.
You wait until, okay.
Whose question is this, yours or mine? You just answered two questions in a row.
Okay, go.
But this is my favorite. We see some connection.
We.
Yeah, I think clearly Queen Victoria wrote this question. Okay, so first of all, if you have a Macintosh computer and you use the photo app and you store your digital photos there, you know how it has that function where it will like identify people by their faces and will label them, and then once you've told it enough people, this is Ayala, this is Rose, this is Sophie, it will start to label them on its own. Jonathan Lethem's actually a friend of ours. We've known him for many years, and he and his family spend the summers in Maine, on the coast of Maine, and we spend the summers pretty nearby, and we see a lot of them. We have a lot of pictures of them, and iPhoto, or now it's just called Photos, will just... Every picture we have of Jonathan Lethem is identified as me. He says, Michael. Jonathan published a book called You Don't Love Me Yet, and the cover, at least in the U.S., was a picture of a photo of Jonathan when he was 20, 21 years old, sitting on a bed with an electric guitar, and that jacket came... the advanced reading copy, and my kids were standing around, and like I picked up the book and I turned a picture on that, just like thinking like, look, here's a picture of Jonathan Lethem when he was a kid. And I showed it to our daughter Rose, who was probably like eight at the time, and I said, look, you know who this is? I covered the name, right? And she goes, you. I said, no. And she's like, Jonathan.
So the story about bumping into that guy.
Like 6 months ago, I was at the Ace Hotel in New York City. I was staying at the Ace Hotel, and I was checking out. I had done some walking around or something, so I had checked my suitcase with the bellman at the hotel, and I came back to retrieve it, and I was waiting for him to get my bag, and I'm just standing in the lobby, and I see this young man kind of like walk past me. He kind of like looks at me, and then like a minute later, he kind of walks back the other way, and he's looking at him. This time, he's like smiling a little bit. I'm like, okay, here we go. He's recognized me, and he's gonna come over to me. And then, sure enough, like a second later, he comes in. He goes, "Oh, excuse me, are you Jonathan Lethem?" And I said, "Are you like, oh, no?" And he's like, "Oh, okay." And he like turned away, and we walked away. And then he stopped, and he turned back, and he said, "Are you sure?" But I mean, I think all of that sort of physical resemblance aside, I do see, I mean, I feel a very strong sense of connection to Jonathan personally and to his work in particular. We have so many of the same personal interests, from rock and roll music to comic books to baseball. We both, in our separate, very distinct ways, grew up in racially integrated communities, in his case, on the streets of Brooklyn, New York, and in my case, on the very much more tranquil streets of Columbia, Maryland, which was a sort of planned community that was built in Maryland, in which was intended to be racially integrated. And so we both grew up like around black kids. When I read his novel, Fortress of Solitude, in which he details some of the sort of humiliating treatment he was subjected to because he was a white kid, and especially the excruciating pain of the song "Play That Funky Music, White Boy," which came out when he and I were exactly the same age, more or less. We are about the same age, you know. He's a kindred soul. in many ways. And I do feel a sense of connection, but I think in some ways our careers have sort of interestingly like crisscrossed, because he came out of genre fiction very strongly. He started out by writing science fiction, and his first couple books were more or less in that genre, and he was well recognized within the world of sort of experimental science fiction in the US as a sort of promising talent. And then since then he has kind of moved outward or moved onward or whatever, however you might want to describe it. And it's been a while since he's done anything really strongly genre related. And I kind of have moved in the opposite way. I started out very much sort of literary, quote unquote, and publishing stories in the New Yorker, and have moved in the direction of a genre more strongly. And it's been years since I had a short story in the New Yorker, whereas he seems to publish them routinely now. So we've crisscrossed. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you all so much.
It's been really fun. Thank you. Great audience.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.